The views and opinions expressed on the following program are those of the host and guests and do not necessarily represent those of any organization, including One Generation Away.
The freedom of a people to choose its leaders is the root of liberty.
Keep alive this experiment in liberty.
Liberty, in case you've forgotten, is the soul's right to breathe.
Government should be very minimal in protecting liberty.
Peace cannot be purchased at the cost of liberty.
The sturdy ground of liberty.
Liberty once lost is lost forever.
Fight for their liberty and for our security.
Guarantees individual liberty.
This great republic born alone in liberty.
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 Liberty. Just how much do you want liberty?
This is Liberty Nation with Tim Donner, cutting through the double talk, taking on the topics, going after what the politicians really mean, and making it all clear for your freedom and your liberty. Liberty Nation with Tim Donner.
Can the Republicans survive Roy Moore? Can they actually pass tax reform? Can they do anything right? Welcome back into Liberty Nation, and we are at a critical crossroad for the Republican Party. We'll discuss the impossible situation the GOP finds itself in regarding the Senate candidate from Alabama accused of sexual misconduct a long time ago with five separate teenagers, and the ever-wavering prospects for tax reform with LibertyNation.com political correspondent Graham Noble. Plus, we'll break down President Trump's long journey through Asia with LibertyNation.com international correspondent Mark Angelides. And we'll discuss why the nation's biggest wiretap operation may not be legal in Talkin' Liberty with Scott Cosenza, constitutional lawyer and legal correspondent for Liberty Nation.
Say what? One more time.
But we get this party started with Say What, where we unveil some of the most wacky, astonishing, and damnable things uttered by politicians and the chattering class. And so the allegations of sexual misconduct with teenagers almost 40 years ago have mounted against Roy Moore. But there was an almost inadvertent but very revealing comment made by Van Jones of CNN, former Obama administration official, who said on election night that Trump's election was because of a white lash. And he's now doubling down, saying that Steve Bannon, chief defender of Roy Moore, has stoked, and this is coming from a hard leftist and self-avowed communist, racial identity politics.
This is Bannonism on trial. Bannon is trying to create the sense of an aggrieved identity group, frankly, a white aggrieved identity group that's under siege by everyone. And this is that in its worst form. So you're not supposed to vote as a father. You're not supposed to vote as a brother. You're not supposed to vote as a woman. You're supposed to vote as a member of this identity group against the world.
Which is exactly what the left has been doing and saying for the last decade. Only their identity groups were blacks and Hispanics and women's and gays and so forth, who were instructed to vote based on their ethnic, racial, or gender identity. But now, when white people supposedly vote in their interest, they are accused of the same identity politics. This was spawned by the left, this identity politics, and now it is boomeranging right back on them. As far as Moore himself, he told Sean Hannity on Fox News that he denies all of the allegations.
These allegations are completely false and misleading. But more than that, it hurts me personally because, you know, I'm a father. I have one daughter. I have five granddaughters, and I have a special concern for protection of young ladies. I don't know Ms. Corpman from anybody. I never talked to her, never had any contact with her. Allegations of sexual misconduct with her are completely false. I believe they're politically motivated. I believe they're brought only to stop a very successful campaign, and that's what they're doing.
But the left and their cohorts in the establishment media are not really needed to take down Roy Moore. The Republicans are taking care of that themselves, witness Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell.
I believe the women, yes. I think he should step aside.
Are you encouraging a write-in campaign with Senator Strange?
That's an option we're looking at. whether or not there is someone who could mount a write-in campaign successfully.
Of course, that would split the GOP vote and likely hand the election to the Democrat, Doug Jones. Now, it's very possible that Moore did what he's accused of, and that the timing of all of this is beyond suspicious. I mean, the Washington Post could have come out with this story before Alabama Republicans voted in their primaries, two of them. But it wasn't until Moore survived two separate votes and won the final round against the establishment Republican Luther Strange, and his name was placed on the ballot where it can no longer be removed, that the Post published these stories. So Moore may have done what he's accused of, or some of what he's accused of, but the fact remains that the Post picked the most damaging time to drop these bombshells. Of course, that's within their rights. But the question is whether the voters of Alabama will now be driven more by the allegations against Roy Moore or the fact that they were revealed by a media giant widely reviled in Alabama at the most damaging possible time. And so the decision on what to do about Roy Moore is now where it should be, in the hands of the voters of Alabama. Meanwhile, the elite media is again all over President Trump for saying things about Vladimir Putin that are unacceptable to the leftist global New World Order. This time, it was for Trump saying, well, if you can decode it, that he believes that Putin believes that Russia did not interfere in the presidential election.
I believe he believes that, and that's very important for somebody to believe. I believe that he feels that he and Russia did not meddle in the election. As to whether I believe it or not, I'm with our agencies, especially as currently constituted with their leadership. I believe in our intel agencies, our intelligence agencies. I've worked with them very strongly.
Wow, a lot of belief in there. Trump believes that Putin believes, six different beliefs in that quote. But of course, the left went nuts anyway. So what else is new? But with all the opposition to Moore and to President Trump from within his own party, the left becomes almost superfluous in this fight. After George W. Bush, for example, broke 8 years of silence where he refused to say anything about President Obama, he then came out and attacked Trump recently, and one of George W. Bush's chief advisors in the White House, Matthew Dowd, sounded bitter in a recent appearance on NBC.
The Republican Party as we know it, the party of Ronald Reagan, the party of George W. Bush, is gone. The party now is the Donald Trump Party. 80% or 85% of the Republican voters, regardless of what the Republicans say in Washington, that walk around the halls of the Capitol and say what they think the Republican Party is, that party is long gone. And they have to come to terms with the idea this is the Trump, Steve Bannon party that is more welcoming to somebody like Roy Moore than it is to somebody like Jeff Flake.
You know, hearing that and George W. Bush's recent attack on Trump, it occurred to me that Bush has now become the Republicans' version of Jimmy Carter. Think about it. Bush left the presidency with historically low approval, like Jimmy Carter. His party got beaten badly in the next election, like Jimmy Carter. And then when the memories of him had finally faded, he re-enters the public stage, somehow believing anyone on either side of the aisle even cares what he thinks anymore, like Jimmy Carter. Jimmy Carter and George W. Bush, the two most unpopular presidents in the last 40 years. But the Republicans' continuing lack of popularity presents the real possibility that Democrats could take control of the House in next year's midterms. And if so, a Democrat House would most likely introduce a resolution of impeachment against President Trump. And the left is already laying the groundwork with an ad by leftist billionaire and major cash cow for the Democrats, Tom Steyer.
He's brought us to the brink of nuclear war, obstructed justice at the FBI, and in direct violation of the Constitution, he's taken money from foreign governments and threatened to shut down news organizations that report the truth. If that isn't a case for impeaching and removing a dangerous president, then what has our government become? I'm Tom Steyer, and like you, I'm a citizen who knows it's up to us to do something. It's why I'm funding this effort to raise our voices together and demand that elected officials take a stand on impeachment.
Now, Steyer's apparently spent about $10 million in running this ad all over the country. And just so you understand, as Donald Trump would say, Tom Steyer is a guy who made billions in and through the fossil fuel industry and is now apparently trying to exorcise his guilty conscience by pouring millions into leftist causes. Not dissimilar to George Soros, who made billions through the ultimate capitalist technique of currency manipulation and then spends billions trying to tear down capitalism. We're covering all this stuff, the Roy Moore situation, tax reform, Trump's standing, all of it and much more at LibertyNation.com, where truth is making a comeback. Up next, what are Republicans to do about Roy Moore? With no good outcome on the horizon, we'll be joined by LibertyNation.com Washington political correspondent Graham Noble to discuss whether and how the Republican Party can survive this growing political scandal.
Liberty Nation with Tim Donner.
What we have heard here today has been a political spectacle.
We elect these guys to run the country. They're just not doing their job.
This is Liberty Nation with Tim Donner.
So what's a political party to do? What are Republicans to do about Roy Moore, the now explosively controversial Senate candidate in Alabama, charged with inappropriate sexual conduct with five different teenagers almost 40 years ago? The Republican Party, already under fire from its own base and deeply unpopular, appears to have no good options or no good outcome to this whole fiasco. And here to help us unravel this tangled web of allegations and accusations and recriminations that will soon come to a head and talk about the critical issue of tax reform and the standing of President Trump these days is Graham Noble, Washington political correspondent for LibertyNation.com. And Graham, are we past the point where Roy Moore can even get a hearing about this issue? Has the barn door closed on anyone actually believing Moore's denials now that all these GOP members of Congress and other conservatives are bailing on him, the Senate majority leader and many Republicans and conservatives calling for him to drop out of the race? Are we past the point where Moore can get any kind of a hearing on this issue?
I believe that he is never going to get any kind of fair hearing, you know, in either what we like to call the court of public opinion or in the media. That this is the subject of sexual harassment, or you know, is a very, very difficult subject for anybody to even be willing to stand up and say, you know, look, you know, let's not pass judgment on this guy. Because the moment you even do that, I mean, you know, members of the public maybe can do it, but the moment another Republican politician stands up and publicly says, let's not pass judgment on Roy Moore, everyone immediately piles on and says that they are, you know, trivializing the whole subject of sexual harassment.
Of all the possible perilous outcomes for the GOP, Graham, which is worse, that Moore is beaten and the Democrats gain a seat in a Senate where the GOP already has a razor-thin margin and includes senators like John McCain and Jeff Flake, both essentially lame ducks who can't be counted on to vote for anything favored by President Trump? Or would it be worse if he's elected and is seated by the Senate? Or would it be worse if Moore is elected and then the Senate refuses to seat him?
Well, I think just from a strictly political point of view, it's pretty disastrous if Moore's Democratic opponent wins this special election. If Roy Moore does actually still win this special election, which I think is I think it's still possible that he might do. I certainly wouldn't rule out him actually still winning. And if he does so, I would almost think that the GOP really needs to let him take his seat in the Senate and kind of, I don't know, you know, suffer the slings and arrows that will go along with that. I mean, after all, the man has not been convicted of any crimes here. You know, we're still supposed to be operating on the idea that a man is innocent until proven guilty.
Innocent, proven guilty in a court of law or in the court of public opinion?
Yeah, my personal opinion, and I would have to say from a strictly personal point of view, I've never been a great fan of Roy Moore anyway. I would have much preferred if Mo Brooks had actually been the candidate for that seat.
Agreed.
But nevertheless,
agreed.
I believe that if he was to win the election, that the GOP should just let him take his seat and you know, deal with whatever consequences come along with that.
Well, I have seen two polls recently, one in Alabama, one which has Doug Jones, a Democrat, leading Moore by 2 points. But the other one that just came out has Moore leading by 6 points. So it's still very realistic that he could win that race. As a matter of fact, I think it would still be considered an upset if any Democrat wins a Senate seat in Alabama, no matter the conduct of the Republican running against him. But do you think this fiasco with Roy Moore will give the GOP a new sense of urgency about passing tax reform before a possible Moore victory in his special election on December 10th, so they can at least accomplish something, and tax reform is something big, before they start getting hammered in the event of a Roy Moore victory?
Well, Tim, you would think that this situation would inspire a sense of urgency amongst congressional Republicans. I'm not at all optimistic that tax reform is getting done anytime soon.
Well, so as you look deeper at tax reform, the House and Senate versions of it have some real differences, though the similarities really seem to outnumber the differences. I think that's clear. What makes you either optimistic or, as you've just said, pessimistic that tax reform will actually happen? And what kind of odds would you lay at this point that they do get it done?
If I was a gambling man, I would not want to put money on tax reform getting done anytime in the near future. I mean, I think that, you know, the problem that the Republicans have, and it's the problem they had with healthcare, is that they have just such a slim majority in the Senate, and of course the Democrats have absolutely no interest whatsoever in even allowing the Republicans any kind of success. And they certainly don't want any part of the Trump agenda to be translated into legislation. So, you know, the no Democrats are ever getting on board with anything that the Republicans do. And then, of course, you even have, you know, a couple of Republican senators who are not playing ball either, and that's all it takes for everything to get held up. So I don't think the odds of tax reform getting done anytime soon are particularly good.
All right, thank you, Graham. Thanks for spending some time with us today.
Thank you.
Graham Noble, Washington political correspondent at LibertyNation.com. Up next, we'll break down President Trump's grand tour of Asia with LibertyNation.com international correspondent Mark Angelides.
Liberty Nation with Tim Donner.
What we have heard here today has been a political spectacle.
We elect these guys to run the country. They're just not doing their job.
This is Liberty Nation with Tim Donner.
Well, President Trump's grand tour through 5 countries in Asia is now complete. And while the coverage has been spotty because of a domestic issue, tax reform, and the scandal surrounding Alabama Senate candidate Roy Moore, this was a trip of critical importance in the president's attempt to isolate North Korea and the nuclear threat posed by the ultimate rogue regime in Pyongyang. A lot of work was done by the president in his visits to Japan, South Korea, China, Vietnam, and the Philippines over 12 days. And joining us now is the man who has chronicled Trump's grand tour as exhaustively as anyone in the entire media. Mark Angelides, our man on the ground in London for LibertyNation.com. Hello, Mark.
Hello, Tim.
Well, thanks for jumping on board again. And we spoke with you last week about the first half, roughly, of the president's grand tour, as you call it in the British parlance. So tell us what the president accomplished in the second half of the trip to China, Vietnam, and the Philippines.
Well, overall, he's accomplished an extraordinary amount, especially in terms of laying out what his vision is for the Jacksonian foreign policy, that America will help out where it can, but it's not going to get directly involved in foreign matters. But at the same time, it was really, for me, this came across as very much a Make America Great Again tour. In terms of what he's talking about with trade and doing different deals with nations, not on a free trade basis, but on a trade that is mutually beneficial basis. For example, we did an interview on Liberty Nation a while back with Sebastian Gorka, who talked about the unusuality of free trade deals and how they're not exactly what a free market economy looks like. And really, with President Trump, what he's been doing in this last half of the tour is setting out a vision for this is how America will trade, and these are the conditions under which she'll trade. And they don't involve going into the TTP trade arrangements, things that would be bad for the sovereignty of the nations.
Now, let me jump in here with a question about what you refer to as a Jacksonian foreign policy of Donald Trump, referring to President Andrew Jackson. But he was in office almost 200 years ago. So how can you draw a straight line from the foreign policy of an admittedly populist nationalist president 200 years ago to Trump of today? What is a Jacksonian foreign policy?
Well, that is what's at the heart of the MAGA tradition here, the MAGA platform. What it essentially means is that America will be a good neighbor, a good friend to all countries. If the countries need help with something, then America will be there ready to help, as allies should. But it won't get involved and start fighting your wars for you. You know, that is off the table. It's completely off the table. And also in terms of that America will be doing what is best for America. And if that happens to coincide with what's best for your country, too, then all the well and good. That sounded like Orwell, didn't it? That all well and good.
Yes. Double entendre.
Yeah. But really what it means is that it's America first. America will keep its nose out of other people's business. It will provide help when needed, but will not fight wars at the behest of foreign nations, governments, or organizations such as the UN, NATO, things like this.
Okay, well, fair enough. Now let's go back to Trump's trip. The media... we'll talk about the media in a second, but first the issue of those billions of dollars in new deals that Trump said he hammered out on his trip. Will these deals actually make a difference in the economy, or are they largely of symbolic value?
Well, what you have to understand is that many deals that are hammered out are not just single purchases. They're initial investments that will go in to different things. Now, of course, primarily what the president's been talking about is deals on weapons and tech. That's the main thing. It's what America makes best out of anybody in the world. So there'll be a lot of weapons deals going down, which is a good bump for the economy. But these will be long-term things. I mean, if you get a customer and they like your products, it's something that they're going to keep buying. And nobody does weaponry better than the Americans. So these are long-term trade things. And of course, if legislation's in place to make trade easier between the countries, and I stress again, not a free trade deal, but trade arrangements, if these are in place for one product, it's very, very easy to put these over for other products and services. Yes, in terms of, Trump's quoted the figure of $300 billion and suggested that it's going to work out more like $1 trillion by the time it's done. And for anybody who knows even basic trade arrangements, that's quite an underestimation. $1 trillion based off $300 billion initial deals, it's pretty modest. So, yeah, I think this is going to be very, very good for the American economy. And, of course, what President Trump was aiming for, it's good for their economies, too.
Well, it seems that the logistics are maybe the largest issue of pulling out of these big multilateral deals and having to cut bilateral deals with each individual nation. Just the logistics of that have got to be challenging. We continue here on Liberty Nation Radio with Mark Angelides. Mark, the media's picked up on some of the president's awkward phrasing, and of course some of the outfits he wore in deference to various national cultures in Asia. But did the president say or do anything on this trip that should raise red flags?
Okay, well, it's been an unfortunate week for the media, because they've been living off swamp gas, I believe is the American term. The president really hasn't put a foot wrong. I mean, they can mock him for wearing traditional shirts, but these are specifically at the APEC and ASEAN summits. But these were handed out to all world leaders who all wore them and had their photos taken together.
Right.
It's hardly just a Donald Trump made a bad dress decision. This was a...
No, I know, but it pretty much they like to present a singular picture of the president wearing an outfit. Yeah, so it looks like he's just, you know, kind of making it up as he goes.
Yeah, I don't know if you caught the one in Japan where where President Shinzo Abe and President Donald Trump were feeding the koi fish.
Yes.
And the president almost unceremoniously dumped his box of the remainder of his fish feed into the pond. And this did the rounds all over the media, people saying he's killed the fish, can't believe what he's done. And then 12 hours later, the rest of the tape came out where President Abe Shinzo did exactly the same thing. But as you say, instead of looking at the broader picture, they've taken a single snapshot. Whereas if they'd showed the whole video initially, it would have been honest, but there wouldn't have been the anti-Trump propaganda wing moving in it.
Okay, so let's wrap this up by having you give us what you believe should be the headlines from Trump's grand tour through Asia.
Okay. Well, I mean, there's a few that could be presented. I guess Trump redefines trade for the globalists would be a good headline, I think, especially in light of the fact that the transatlantic trade partnership got reignited, much to the chagrin of every freedom-loving person in the world. And President Trump, obviously, one of his first acts as president was to get the U.S. out of that. I'd say another good headline would be MAGA hits the world stage, because now the Asian nations are beginning to realize this is what is behind President Trump's vision for trade and vision for the U.S., which is sovereignty and wealth. The last one would be Trump proves presidential.
Well, there you go. That's a shocker.
Yeah.
Thank you, Mark.
Very welcome.
Mark Angelides, LibertyNation.com's man on the ground in London. Quick break, and then we're back to discuss why the largest wiretap operation in the United States may not be legal. In Talkin' Liberty with LibertyNation.com legal correspondent Scott Cosenza.
Liberty Nation with Tim Donner.
And now we welcome you into the portion of Liberty Nation, which we entitle Talkin' Liberty. It is self-explanatory. as we are joined by our regular contributor, constitutional lawyer, and LibertyNation.com legal correspondent Scott Cosenza. Hello, Scott.
Hello, Tim.
Justice officials fear the nation's biggest wiretap operation may not be legal. Explain, please.
Well, Tim, I thought this was a fascinating story from USA Today. Brad Heath is their correspondent that handles these sorts of issues, and he does a very good job. It's a fascinating story that comes out of Riverside County, California, and the discussion is that federal law enforcement agents, chiefly fighting the drug war, have, instead of going to federal court to try to get wiretap permissions for some of the suspects that they're chasing, have instead gone to state court to avoid the increased scrutiny, both within their own departments before being able to seek those warrant and wiretap permissions from a court, and then from the courts themselves that they would then have to go seek the permission from. And the story details how these anonymous Justice Department employees are talking about how it's problematic that they're doing so. And I think it's sort of setting the case for us to read about how in the future, the millions of dollars in investigatory funds have basically been blown, because when these people are eventually tried, if their attorneys challenge these warrants and wiretaps in court, which one presumes they would, especially if they were secured under less than what we might say the best circumstances from a law enforcement perspective.
Less than optimal.
Then we might see some of those or most or all of those warrants stricken down by federal courts.
So what happens then?
Then it's just a giant waste. The millions of dollars have spent, the thousands of hours of resources of federal law enforcement's time would just go down the drain. And that's what's sort of... that's the point of the story, and what's troubling about it is that our federal law enforcement officers are not doing the most they can in order to secure their own investigations and also do the most they can in order to make sure that the constitutional rights of Americans are upheld.
Okay, the new U.S. government rules are restricting travel and trade with Cuba in something that many people, Scott, are saying is a return to the days of the Cold War, because Cuba no longer represents any kind of threat to us. Is this what Trump has in mind, to take us back to where we were before Obama?
We talked a number of times on this program over the past couple of years about and various stories about the opening up of Cuba to persons in the United States, including the opening up of airline routes, regularly scheduled commercial air traffic, and so on and so forth. And those airlines are now canceling their flights. And what we're seeing is these rule changes, they say that they're designed to hurt sort of the government-owned and state, you know, sort of mechanisms where an infusion of tourist cash will basically buoy the Castros and their lieutenants, right? And you can understand that. But there are also a number of restrictions that have now been added on by the Trump administration that seem to really go against freedom, both the freedom of the Americans who may travel to Cuba and of Cuban citizens. And I think the most troubling aspect is that it's harder for people to travel there individually. So just buy a ticket and go to Cuba like you would any other country. You need to be able to show a, quote, full-time schedule with activities that support the Cuban people and show, quote, meaningful interaction going beyond merely staying in rooms in private homes and eating in private restaurants. Now,
what's the definition of meaningful interaction?
Well, here's the thing, though, too. Yeah. We're trying to teach these people about what a free market economy could be, right? What would be more meaningful than that? What would undermine the Castro regime more than private Americans going over and dealing privately with other Cubans? That seems to be...
Well, this is the fundamental issue, and you can see it from both standpoints. On the one hand, you say, if everybody says the goal is to make Cuba more free, then do you do that by restricting the capacities and the cash flow to a corrupt communist government, Or do you do that by bombarding the island with all kinds of private capital that right. will expose real capitalism to the people of Cuba who've never been exposed to it? It's a tough argument. I've always come down on the side that more freedom, more capitalism will ultimately break down the system in Cuba. But others
we know
disagree.
That trade makes for good neighbors, and we know that look at what happened to Vietnam. We're Donald Trump's in China right now, right? And we have a great relationship with them. We're not on the brink of war with China. Why is that? Well, because of, I would say, our strong trade ties. We don't have strong cultural or other ties to them. No, they are our most valued trading partner, and we are theirs.
Of course, China's an anomaly because they're at once communist and capitalist. I mean, they are communist in terms of the ability to speak freely and to express yourself and have First Amendment type rights. They are communist through and through, really. But on the other side, they're a rapidly developing industrial power with a growth rate that has ranged from 6 to 10% over the last several years. So
for me, the key difference is they don't shoot you if you try to leave. Like
that's a big one.
So
that's
Cuba, North Korea.
That's kind of a baseline one. Right. And we're not going to gun you down if you want to leave the country. All right. Jeff Sessions says that the Obama marijuana policy will remain in effect while he's Attorney General and during this Trump administration. So what is the Obama marijuana policy, and will it, in fact, remain in effect? Will it remain unchanged from the days of the 44th to here to the 45th president?
Well, Sessions testified yesterday on the Hill, and all the press was basically about the Russia stuff, which is important. But this, I think, is a very important guidance that was up in the air until yesterday, which was, where does Sessions come down on this? His previous statements, both to congressional leaders and to the press, left people sort of wondering, is he going to, you know, at any moment try to sort of reverse the course? And as more states and more business and more billions of dollars depend on the Justice Department's treatment of these issues, it becomes very consequential. And so what we're talking about is the Obama Holder Lynch Justice Department basically and congressional funding restrictions said, as long as people were obeying state laws in the states they were operating in, the federal government wasn't going to enforce federal marijuana laws against them.
Kind of like don't ask, don't tell.
That's the idea, right?
Sense,
if you,
yes.
you know, now the federal government hasn't always upheld this operating rubric, I guess you might call it. Mm-hmm. And in fact, when Obama first came in, he was horrible from the perspective of those of us that are anti-prohibitionist. And he directed federal authorities to basically smash and grab at California.
It was one of
clinics.
The most. It was one of the most surprising elements
yes.
of the Obama administration.
Yeah, and Sessions has basically made these statements, sort of statements that are wildly inflammatory about marijuana and marijuana users. So the question is the policy going to be the same? At least the articulated policy. Again, it may differ in terms of its execution, but that was the question. And Sessions said unequivocally, our policy is the same fundamentally as the Holder Lynch policy, and that the federal law basically is not going to, you know, they're not going to send federal agents in to prosecute these people. So as long as they're operating, again, under state law legally. So that's the current position. It's good to see some clarification on this matter from the Justice Department. I think we desperately need some changes in the federal law to recognize how far the country has moved in the last 20 years. But in any case, this is good news from Sessions. And he also said, which was nice to see, given his previous statements, that cannabis isn't as dangerous as heroin, which is, I think, a strong admission from the AG.
Thank you, Scott.
Thanks, Tim.
That is Scott Cosenza of LibertyNation.com. A reminder that the podcast of this radio show, Liberty Nation Radio, plus our own podcast entitled The Uprising, are available to you on LibertyNation.com, as well as fine podcast providers everywhere. So that's it for this week, and wishing all of you a blessed Thanksgiving. We'll be back at you next week, same time, same station. Till then, this is Tim Donner saying stand up for liberty, and we'll see you next time on Liberty Nation.